It was already on. Right. Good morning, everybody. I want to, as I wrote to you last night, I want to begin by looking for a few extra minutes at the gratitude packets from last week. For those of you who didn't get one, I will give them to you. Because I really want to try today to, if possible, to deepen the conversation about gratitude a little bit, and then move to... I think I have one last one. Let's see. And then I would like to spend some time, both together and in Chavruta, thinking about the role of gratitude and giving in one, I think, particularly interesting 20th century Haredi thinker of Eliyahu Dessler. So first, I would like to just try for a minute. I'm not sure I can pull this off. I would like to try to say something about what we tried to say and do last week. And so I'm just getting organized here as we start. I apologize for... Okay. So the steps that we take, right? What I tried to do was really kind of move us in seven steps, I would say, last week, kind of towards a theology of gratitude, right? One, the first, which we saw through looking at the Rambam, was the notion of the world as pure chesed, the world as a manifestation of pure grace on God's part, something that we did not earn, could not earn. And then I sort of added to the Rambam, although I think it's implicit in the Rambam, the notion that our life within the world is grace within grace, or a gift within a gift, right? The gift of consciousness is something we didn't earn, and we inhabit a world which is itself a gift we didn't earn. Then we talked about the nexus, using Heschel, between a sense of wonder, which one could argue is prior to gratitude in some way, and a sense of indebtedness, which one could argue is sort of the consequence of gratitude on the other. And we sort of saw the way Heschel, who wants to use gratitude as a kind of path towards being open to being commanded by God, right, likes the word indebtedness a lot, because it does more work for him in a certain way than the word gratitude alone does. Right? Gratitude may just be, right? Most psychologists these days would dispute that, but gratitude, lest you have the hava amina, lest you think that gratitude might just be an emotion, indebtedness comes with a sense of obligation towards the other. Ma'ashiv la'shem kol tagmulohi alai is indebtedness, right? How will I repay God for all that God has done for me? Then we talked about modani, right? And I tried to emphasize that modani can be read as a kind of anticipation of and refusal of the notion of the Cartesian eye, right? That on some level there is gratitude and there is relationship even before there is a self, that I am born in the context of relationship and a web of obligations and commitments. Then we talked briefly about Rabbeinu Bachya and Heschel together, emphasizing that the biggest danger to a life of gratitude is simply the kind of perennial human temptation to take things for granted. And that in a certain way, spiritual life is about resisting the temptation to just sort of see the world. The world is, because the world is, and this is just how life is. We didn't talk about this passage last week, but Heschel says at one point in God in Search of Man, since there is a need for daily wonder, there is a need for daily worship. And that sentence, I think, is actually about precisely this, right? It's so easy to say, okay, on Monday I was grateful, on Tuesday I was grateful, on Wednesday I was just tired, right? And the purpose of davening in his mind, but not just davening, I think, you know, worship more broadly is to sort of push against the temptation to take things for granted. Fifth, I talked about my attempt to find a way to articulate a theology of gratitude that also makes space for disappointment. And hence, the connection between Hallel and Kohelet on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. Six, I talked about the notion of cultivating a sense of gratitude even when we have less than we want and arguably even less than we need. What does it mean for the Torah to say, V'achalta v'savata uverachta, you should bless when you're full? And as the Gemara sort of places in God's mouth, B'nai Israel decide to say Berkat HaMazon, decide to say grace after meals, even when they've only had the littlest bit. And that's not just some weird halakha, that's supposed to be a kind of existential way of being in the world. I have less than I want, and yet I'm still able to say thank you. And it's actually more forceful than that. It's not just less than I want, because it may even be less than I need. V'savata, you should be satisfied, doesn't really... I'm not sure that that's purely a subjective category, right? It may be an objective category. I may, in fact, have less than I need, not just less than I want. And then finally, we talked about the sort of intertwinedness of gratitude to God and gratitude to people. And we saw the way in which, for Chazal, the person they use as the illustration of that nexus is Paro, who begins the book of Exodus by saying, about whom we learn in the beginning of the book of Exodus, that he did not have any gratitude to Joseph. And then we hear him say, just a short while later, I don't know God. And for Chazal, that's a kind of really interesting web that can't fully be disentangled, that a lack of gratitude moves back and forth between the spheres. Okay, that's basically what we did last time. A couple people who are here now who were not here last time, if you want an audio version of last time, if that's interesting to you, it's now up on the website, and I can send you a link if you have trouble navigating it. Any sort of questions or comments before we actually sort of keep going to step to the next step? Okay, so... All right, so let's turn for a second. In the packet from last time, I want to just look just for a few minutes at a couple of last things. So first of all, a brief passage from Reb Simcha Zissel Ziv, who was one of the most important leaders of the Musar movement in Eastern Europe. His sort of shmoozes, his talks, are collected in a set of volumes called Chochma u'Musar. And you have here the English, but also the Hebrew on the next page. Okay? And this is really, I don't know if this... Well, I don't know whether this adds a whole nother dimension or whether it's just a sort of interesting drasha about gratitude, but I want to just spend a minute on it. I'll read in Hebrew and translate, and hopefully it'll be close to the translation in English, since it's the same translator. Re'ei, kama kfui tova haya paro b'chol Mitzrayim. Says, see, how ungrateful, to what extent Paro and all of Egypt turned over the good that was done to them. Hanir elefi midatenu, it would seem according to our way of thinking, to I think he means here to a kind of human way of thinking, that even more than Ammon and Moab, who, famously, we are told, can never enter into God's community, right? It would seem that the Egyptians did the most horrible thing ever. They enslaved us for generations. They would have gone on enslaving us forever. And if we think about sort of the midrashic elaborations of that, they did it with the most unimaginably savage brutality. So Simcha Zissel says, by the logic of sort of kal vachomer, right? By the logic of from small to big, you would say, if Ammon and Moab can't marry into the Jewish people, surely the Egyptians can't either. But he says, v'im kol zeh, but nevertheless... Now he's going to quote a pasuk that I've mentioned before, which is one of the most darshan verses in the Torah, uninterpreted verses of the Torah, even though it's kind of amazing. He's hira haTorah lo titaev mitzri ki ger hayita be'artzo. That is Dvarim Chaf Gimel Chet, Deuteronomy 23:8. You shall not hate the Egyptian, for you were a stranger in his land. Now, right, we don't need to belabor this, but it's sort of like an obvious point. You could imagine the Torah basically saying, you know, of all the people in the world who deserve to be hated, it's probably the Egyptians. And, you know, there is something a little counterintuitive about lo tita'iv mitzri ki ger ha'ita bar. So you shouldn't hate the Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land, right? Bracketed from that sentence is, which he exploited relentlessly, killing countless of you, and, right, reducing you to the most extreme forms of oppression and degradation. And the Torah doesn't do that here, right? It simply says, lo tita'iv mitzri ki ger ha'ita bar tso, which I think most commentators understand as, look, there was a time when you had no place to be, and at least you had a home there. And then, by the way, the next pasuk that he doesn't quote says that in the third generation, the Egyptians can marry in, which is, in some ways, what he most has in mind here. In other words, because it seems like an explicit contrast to Ammon and Moab. Right? Ammon and Moab can never marry in, and the Egyptians can marry in the third generation. Now, by the way, just as a sort of footnote, this is not a sort of theology of hatred, non-hatred, enemies, non-enemies, because, for example, he does not deal with the question of, okay, so why are Ammon and Moab actually out for all times? Or, B, the question that many sort of sensitive readers say, okay, but how does Amalek fit into this equation? Right? He doesn't deal with either of those questions. That's not what he's interested in here. He's giving a kind of a sermonic push, right? And here's what he says, right? Again, just to read that line again, Aval im kol zeh, ger hayita be'artzo. I'm sorry, I skipped a little bit. Ve'avadeta oto befarech, right? He worked you to the bone, right? Aval im kol zeh, ger hayita be'artzo. Even though he oppressed you, nevertheless, he gave you a place to live. It's really an amazing statement. And actually, I think there's interesting things to say here about the history of different ways that Jews and Christians both have held to a certain view that says, oh, Christianity is about loving your enemy, and Judaism is about being more realistic and fighting your enemy. You know, depending on where you're standing when you say that, you mean it as a compliment to one or the other. And actually, I think the history of both is much more complicated, right? As the history of Christian murder of non-Christians points out, and as the history of lo tita'iv mitzri also complicates. So, right, usually, as many of you have heard me say many times, any kind of typology like that is usually wrong about both sides, which are always more complicated. So he says, "Ve'ad olam anu mitzuvim liskor tashlum gmulahem lekarvam tachat kanfei hashchina." Right, and for all eternity, we are commanded to actually repay our debt to them by seemingly, by bringing them into the congregation of God. Now, I don't know whether he means here permitting them or actively missionizing to them. I suppose you could read Chaf Gimel Tet in Dvarim either way. But either way, the point is, right, you should not chase them away, but you should be welcoming to them. And then he says, right, and this is sort of his point, Uma gadol hachov liskor tova amitit she'adam oseh lechavero. Atmaha. What does Atmaha mean in Aramaic? You've seen this if you studied Midrash. It doesn't appear in the Bavli, I don't think, but it appears in Midrashim all the time. Atmaha literally means, I mean, figuratively means, question mark. Or better, question mark, exclamation point. Right? It's sort of a way of saying, like, you know the word in Rashi will often say, bitmiha, right? When Rashi thinks that you might read a sentence in the Gemara declaratively when it's actually intended to be a question, he'll say, bitmiha. It's a question. Atmaha, with Breshit Rabbah, this happens all the time. Question mark, exclamation point. So he says, right, if we are commanded for all eternity to feel gratitude to the Egyptians, how much more so to someone who actually genuinely does something for us? Or does something genuinely good for us? Or does something good out of genuine intentions? Those are all ways of rendering what Tova Amitit might mean. Right? It's interesting. That phrase is not as simple as it seems, right? A genuine good, good done from a genuine place. Those things overlap, but they're not exactly synonyms. Okay? So his argument is, right, if the Torah asks us for all eternity, that is, by canonizing it in the Torah, the obligation not to hate the Egyptian and to kind of play out the debt we have towards him, alacha kama v'chama, all the more so to every other debt we could possibly have, which presumably, right, most debts we have are deeper than the debt we might have to the Egyptians. Okay, any thoughts about this before we just sort of, I thought this was just a really interesting sort of moment in the history of Musar about the centrality of gratitude. Yeah, Hannah, please.
I'm just curious that if, so it seems like you're understanding that you were a stranger in his land as he gave you a place to be. And I wonder how, like, about the possibility of that being a statement about how hard it is to be kind to the stranger in your own land. That makes sense.
Like, so say one more sentence.
That maybe what that's expressing is like, rather than gratitude that you had a place to be, like compassion for I don't know about compassion, but like understanding that it's hard to treat the stranger in your land with like full
goodness. So I hope that down the line in the series we're going to spend possibly even a whole session on just the four psukim of the Tanakh about how to treat the stranger, and I think that's definitely there. Whether that's intended here, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there's a way to definitively answer that. The reason why I don't love that reading here is, let's leave Dvarim for a second and talk about him. He's actually talking there. He seems like he's saying, Ger hayita baratso, you were a stranger in his land, as what is the favor that he did you despite his cruelty, right? So that feels like what he's actually saying is they gave you a place to live. Could you kind of overlay a layer of interpretation to it? Totally. You could do that. I think the Torah is deeply aware that the temptation to mistreat the ger is everywhere. Otherwise, it wouldn't need to continually return to telling us not to do that. So, I mean, I think it's a good point, but I don't think it's what he wants from this pasuk. Abby?
Last week in the mood, you taught Rabbi Nachman. Uh-huh. Maybe you don't want to bring that in here, but it seems to fit, which is the imperative to find the good, one good, something good in mm-hmm. every human being. And is this not sort of that same idea? That you basically,
right,
you have to constantly work to see some thread of goodness. Maybe it's not sweetness, but it's ultimately, nobody is irredeemable. And similarly, like, it's almost for us, less for you're not doing the Egyptians such a favor. This is a way that you should constantly be living your life. And so,
yeah, I think that's a really interesting link, which I hadn't thought of. I would actually only sort of tweak it a tiny drop, which is, if anything, if you want to take it in that direction, he's going one step further than Rabbi Nachman, because he's not just talking about finding something good that person has done, but actually making space to recognize something good that person has done for you. Which is, I think, a much more intense demand. I mean, I can talk about people I don't like and say, oh, but at least he's nice to his mother. But it's a lot harder to say, oh yeah, but he also did something nice for me. I mean, think about, by the way, you know, here's a, without getting sort of lost in the depths of this, because this could take us to some really kind of far away places from where we are, but think about a relationship that you've had in your life, if you've ever had one, whether it's with a parent or a sibling or with a close friend or a significant other, that has like been ruptured in a way that really feels like it can't be repaired, and you really feel like that person's behavior was egregious and unmanageable, right? And you work on like finding one inch where you can say, nevertheless, I'm grateful that they were able to do this for me. Right? Because presumably the fact that you got into that relationship in the first place suggests even the most abusive parent on some level is responsible for bringing you life. Even the most, you know, we could play this out. I think that's an interesting place, and it might even be an interesting segue at some point for a discussion about forgiveness and how it does and doesn't work. Right? Whether that's one of the kind of mechanisms for beginning to generate a conversation about forgiveness. But I don't know. Yeah.
To me, I think the most striking thing about the phrase is Kigel Haita. It's the same Kigel Haita as all the times when it says, you have suffered. Think about the suffering that you have had. Right? So, I mean, instead of trying to flip it and say, Kigel Haita here maybe means something positive, if you read it as like, still it's the exact same, from the exact same suffering, you should even for that be able to find gratefulness.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, yeah. I think that you're actually raising an interesting question about reading Chumash, which is something I would like to think about a little more over time, which is it seems like the phrase, Gerim Hayitem, really can mean two different things, right? You were vulnerable and suffered as a result, and that gives rise to all kinds of obligations. In some ways, you could say that for the Torah, that's really like the basis of a kind of ethical passion, right? Or these more sort of like almost pedestrian versions of Kigerim Haita, meaning you were there and you didn't own any property, but they welcomed you. And what you're asking, I think, is whether you should read an element of Aleph in Tibet in all cases. I don't know. Meaning, it would be interesting to actually just look at every time Ger Haita appears in the Chumash and think about that.
David Ingbert's had a session on the mood that was talking about being thankful even for the suffering in Zion, because without it, we couldn't have had the real redemption of having really left.
Yeah, I don't think that's here. That may be it. Right. Fair enough. Right. If you want to talk about gratitude for suffering, you might turn for more dramatically to some Hasidic texts, as well as to arguably to some Gemaras about Rabbi Akiva, right, and his own suffering. It's another discussion which actually, as you say, I realize that, you know, should probably go in an expanded version of this. Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Yeah, Avi.
Yeah, I think the suffering, as it brings redemption, thing is pretty problematic, especially in this regard, because it's a good way to think about suffering, but not about those who brought you suffering, because that's just basically, they just have a sort of utilitarian role in bringing you to redemption. Right? You don't actually gain a deeper understanding.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second, because I think the Torah explicitly makes that point, right? When it says, "V'gamet hagoy asher yavodu dan anochi," right? In other words, right? God says to, right, Avram, your children will be slaves in Egypt, but then seems to push against the notion, oh, therefore the Egyptians are merely the rod of God's anger, to use a phrase about Nebuchadnezzar later, right? And God actually says, no, just to be clear, right, the implementer of the suffering is still culpable, even if there's something to be gained from that suffering. Right? I think that's unequivocally, I don't know if there's any Jewish verse that doesn't. I should never make any statement like that. So let me take that last sentence back. But I think that that's a very powerful thrust, right? Be careful about precisely this. Because at that point, you end up with a theology that says, you know, God forbid, Rahman al-Islam, like, thank you to the Nazis who were able to, and then you can fill in whatever your particular read of the second half of the 20th century is. Create a Jewish state, get over the illusions of plausible life in Europe. I mean, whatever your particular version is, like, you can end up in some very warped places. But I'm sorry, I actually cut you off, so you can finish your thought.
I was pretty much finished.
Oh, okay, great. So I was just commenting on your comment. Okay, thank you. All right. So just to sort of finish this packet, I wanted to show you something just quickly from the Sefer HaChinuch about speaking our gratitude, giving voice to it. Really, I want to read one line. And I'll tell you something. I was a little bit torn a couple of weeks ago when I was working on this packet about whether to include this. And I included it partially. This is going to be a moment of biblical and rabbinic cultural criticism. I included it partially because if you ride the 1 or the 2 train a lot, you probably have seen these disgusting ads that Johnny Walker Black Label now has all over the subways. Right? I mean, they're like, right, they're horrific. What's the ad? The ad is basically, look, men, it's really hard to ever say thank you for anything, so just give a bottle of whiskey instead. Never have to say I love you, man, again, right, in the words of this ad. Never have to say I love you, man, again, or as the motto on almost every one of the things that Johnny Walker has up now is, say it without having to say it, or say it without saying it, something like that, right? And, you know, because what we need in this culture is, right, making men even more unable to talk about their emotions, right? That's really like the vision of the good that ad puts out. And I wanted to to just sort of look at this, because it was interesting. I thought of this, and it was like a really interesting critique, in a way, of that ad. So Sefer HaChinuch is talking about bringing bikurim, about bringing the first fruits to God, or to the Kohanim and God. And you'll recall from Sefer Dvarim, and if you don't recall from Sefer Dvarim, you'll recall from the Passover Haggadah, right, that you do two things when you bring bikurim. You, as it were, give the bottle of whiskey, but then you also say thank you and enumerate the things you're saying thank you for. Right? There's two things. Right? You basically tell your story and talk about why you're there. So he says, Sefer HaChinuch, Mishar Shea Mitzvah, Lefisha Ha'adam, sorry, this is the one thing I did not get to translate, although the first line I translated. Lefisha Ha'adam Me'orer Machshavotav U'mitzayer Bilvavo Ha'emet B'koach Divrei Fiv. That a person stirs his thoughts and conceives or imagines the truth in his heart according to or through the power of actually vocalizing it. Which I think is amazing. The Sefer HaChinuch is one of those books that you can sort of read in this like very like, okay, I'm now going to read a list of 613 things Jews have to do. Like, but he has these like amazing like moments of like these psychological bursts that are really quite amazing. And he actually, I don't know, right? Let me say this differently. He's not saying, I don't think, something about this mitzvah here. He's saying something about life, right? He's saying something about really feeling gratitude is in some way, I'll say this, we'll see if we agree with this, is in some way dependent on actually giving voice to it. That, let's say this philosophically for a second, expressing gratitude is not merely the consequence of feeling it, but it's actually constitutive of feeling it. Is that distinction clear, that sort of philosophies for a second, right? In other words, that it helps form the gratitude. And it's interesting, one of the things that personally I find really sort of interesting about this text is that it doesn't tell you say thank you only at the moment when you fully feel it and then can say thank you with your whole heart. It might actually be saying, subtly or not so subtly, depending on how you read it, sometimes you a little bit feel it, and you a little bit feel resistance to feeling it. So what do? You say it so that you feel it. This becomes yet another version of something that we talked about last time. I talked about this at Limud for anyone who's at this shiur. That right, this sort of Jewish preoccupation, at times at least, with doing things in order to feel them or think them, and not just doing them as a consequence of thinking or feeling them, right? Which I think is really sort of fundamental. And in fact, Sefer HaChinuch, as I think I mentioned last time in passing, says in Mitzvah Tetzayin about Korban Pesach, right, that your actions, your heart follows your actions, and not just the other way around. Acharei ha'maasim nimshachim halvavot. Okay, any thoughts about this? By the way, I think that's all. Let me just say one other thing here. I think that's also why Chazal are so interested in the notion of davening not being merely a contemplative enterprise, by which I mean the centrality in their mind of actually articulating words, and arguably even hearing words at times that are audible, is actually about, because otherwise prayer is something that I'm doing alone, and it's enclosed, and words create a between, right? They create a space between me and God, just as the expression of gratitude creates a space between me and God. Because otherwise, gratitude can be, oh, you know, I feel incredibly grateful to Rachie for all the insightful things she's taught me this year. Have I told her? No, it's something I feel. It's mine. And in a way, the Sefer HaChinuch is sort of saying, there's nothing relational about that gratitude. Whether or not that's fair fully, I'm not sure, but like, I think a critique is actually sort of powerful, right? There's nothing relational there. That's about a feeling that you have, right? It becomes actually relational gratitude when you say thank you, right? Then there's actually something created between the two of you. And dafka saying, right? It's not just giving gifts, but it's also saying, which which is where this text sort of, you know, critiques that at. Okay, anybody else? Anything they want to sort of add or say about this? You have like a very pensive look, son. Maybe that's why you have a pensive look. Okay, so. Okay, so now I would like us to shift gears, and we're going to spend the rest of today's time. There are many copies of this because I originally thought I might get to this with the college program. So I'm going to pass these out, and I'm going to ask you, don't go through this packet yet until we get to talk about it. Also, English for those who want that. We are going to look at an extended essay by Rav Eliyahu Dessler. Rav Eliyahu Dessler, whose dates were 1892 to 1959. Rav Dessler is probably, I think this is probably fair, the most prominent 20th century Musar figure, right? In the world of Musar, of kind of taking ethical self-cultivation as the heart of Jewish spiritual practice, he's kind of the most important 20th century figure. And his students collected, now I think it's like 6 volumes, of his various writings and speeches, which are collected as something called Michtav Me'Eliyahu. Those of you who have not heard of Rav Dessler, some of you have heard of that book. Some of you have probably even heard pieces from that book in bludgeoning speeches that you got from teachers at some point. But Rav Dessler actually, in certain ways, is extremely sort of gentle and psychologically extremely insightful. And he says some things in this essay, which is called Kuntres HaChesed, the sort of pamphlet on loving kindness, that I want us to think about a little bit together. And here, the line between gratitude, which is, as it were, chapter 1 of the sort of the heart of Judaism that I talked about last time, the intrinsic connection of that to chesed, which is, it's chapter 3, right? The lines become blurred in interesting ways, I think. There should be more than enough copies having gone around, right? But here, you need some, you need one? Oh, maybe I do get enough copies. Here. Okay. Okay. Maybe 1 minute for those of you from this very important. Rav Dessler was originally an Eastern European figure who spent 20 years as a rabbi in London. I'm sorry, 20 years as a rabbi in England. Including being the Rosh Kollel at Gateshead, which is kind of the most prominent, I guess you would say, Haredi Kollel. Is that a fair in England? And then eventually makes Aliyah in the late 1940s to become the Mashgiach Ruchani of the Panevich Yeshiva, which is really one of the 2 or 3 most important yeshivot in the Lithuanian learning tradition. And it remains a huge. Rav Shach, who many of you have heard of, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Panevich for a very long time. And the Musar world is fairly small, meaning that Rav Dessler's father was a student of Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv, who we just read. Okay, so let me just say a couple sentences about Rav Dessler, and then we'll set about reading him a little bit. Not about Rav Dessler, about these ideas in Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler... There are more copies of the word. Yeah, what happened to him? What did I just... Oh, here, sorry. I'm losing my mind. Guys, are you eating these? Okay.
Here's 7.
Give them back to me at the end if you don't need them, so I can save some treats here. So, Rav Dessler is going in this essay to develop a typology that is very, very important to him. I think it's sort of fair to say it pervades a lot of what he has to say in general. And I'm going to just share with you that as we set about reading this, I'm hoping that we can together think about a question that always really bothers me about this typology, right? Which I will flesh out in a second. I can't decide whether this typology is so simple as to be like startlingly insightful, or so simple as to be too simple. Like, honestly, I can't decide. I mean, I have a feeling that there are ways in which it's both. But I want us to sort of think about it a little bit together, and what I feel confident about is that even if you come to the conclusion that in certain ways it's too simple, there is core stuff, material in here, that even if you complicate the psychology a little bit, is, I think, enormously powerful and basic. Here's the typology. Rav Dessler says there are two ways of being in the world, which he calls the notain and the notail. Notain and notail, right, mean what? Yeah, the giver and the taker. Right? There are two ways of being in the world. There is one whose fundamental orientation in the world is generosity, kindness, and giving. And there is another whose fundamental way of being in the world is taking, or I think the other way I would translate notail for him is a kind of acquisitiveness, wanting to possess things, wanting things to be mine. It's almost like that passage we read from Heschel last time where he distinguishes between a possession and a gift, right? The preoccupation with possessions. And Rav Dessler would say, you know, this dichotomy, this is like almost everything you need to know about the whole spiritual life. Is this, that there's an otain and there's an otail, and you have to decide which one you are. That's basically like everything else. I mean, he never says it like this. But everything else is sort of idach perusha. Everything else is an explanation, and now let's sort of figure out how to embody the quality of the notain and not the notail. What he will then say, and this is where I get nervous about the simplistic stuff, and I'm grateful to Rav Jason for helping me think this through a little bit. He says, let's just be clear. There is no middle ground. Which, right, yeah. Vicky, I hear you. Okay? Like, there is no middle ground. There's no middle ground. Right? Middle ground is a way of justifying all kinds of failures to be a giver. Reminds me of a great line that the Kutzker Rebbe says, which is totally not relevant to this, but it's one of the Kutzker's great lines. Someone asks him why he's not more moderate, and he says, the middle of the road is for horses. You have to be Eastern European to fully get that joke, but it's a great... meaning people are on one side or the other. Never mind. Okay. Okay. So, before we even look at these words inside, let me ask you about A and B. No tail and no tain, that's A. B is no middle ground. Let's take some thoughts about A first. Is that a useful typology? Is that A so simple as to be unhelpful? Is it so simple as to be totally profound? And we spend all our life obfuscating that fundamental truth? What do we think about that? Georgie, what do you think about that?
I think it's very similar to a dichotomy that I often draw, or I often experience, or think I experience, which is people for whom it is the case that when you ask them for something, people who have a disposition to say yes versus people who have a disposition to say no. So that's kind of what I'm using. And I think they're similar. The person who's inclined, no matter what, to say yes when asked for something is more of a giver. The person who is inclined to say no is the person who wants to keep more, like, possessing.
Great. So I think that's really interesting. I just want to make ask a question that's a little rhetorical, but I want to ask it. The way you said that suggests that A is actually insightful, but even the way you said it means that you reject B. Because you talked about someone being more on the side of A or more on the side of B, right? By which I mean here, no tain and no tail. You didn't say, right, there's the giver and there's the taker. You talked about people have different sort of orientations or inclinations.
Right. So my first inclination was there's no way that B could be true. My second inclination is maybe people have these dispositions and the dispositions are clear cut. But what actually ends up happening in the world is different.
Okay. Okay. Rachie, and then there's a lot of hands up, so we'll just go backwards. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess in my head, I'm sort of thinking as like notate it in the same way as you described when we talked about the Sva Semes and prayer, as he would like to be called, and how there's the, and how like we relate to God in the world. Like there's this framework of love and faith that you don't always love somebody like in moments, but like the it's always there as like the general foundation upon which a relationship stands. Mm-hmm. So notate as like your general framework is giving, and you always. Like, that is, I guess, like, the disposition that you have in, like, every situation. And then maybe if you don't necessarily give in every situation, like, you feel very bad about that. Or you're, the way that you relate to the decision that you just made, even if you didn't give, is, oh, why didn't I give? Like, what justification did I just make in my head not to give? But the general framework upon which, like, all of your decisions stand is notain. And I guess I could say the same for the notel.
Okay. I think, by the way, you were alluding to Rav Tzadok HaKohen, not to Sva Semes, the Tzidkas HaTzadik. The thing about love being the... I don't know which talk...
Oh, wasn't the Kadosh, 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 and the Baruch Kodesh?
Oh, that's neither. That's in Tivot Shalom.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Your comment and Shoshi's are close in some ways, right? I mean, they're about sort of a fundamental orientation. Okay, yeah, there was some, yeah.
I think, yes, Jordan, yeah. Similarly, like, I disagree with Noten and Notel as, like, a linear spectrum, right? And that's why, like, if you picture it as the linear spectrum, then no middle ground is troubling. But if you view it almost more as a circle, right, then the no middle ground makes a lot of sense because the, say that, you know, Notel, right, both of them could go do the same exact mitzvah. But if the notel is doing it to feel good about themselves, whereas the noten is doing it because they genuinely want to help, from an outside perspective, it could look exactly the same. But it's about, like Rachie and Shoshi were saying, about their orientation or what's driving them, their impetus to do it. So I do have trouble imagining no middle ground if I view it as like a linear
right. Right, you know, I'll just sort of say it's a footnote here, and this is a question. This is not of you I'm committed to. I don't know Rav Dessler well enough, and I don't know that this is answerable. But the same way that I said in the lecture I gave on Heschel, on Tefillah a few weeks ago, right, that there are moments when he says things where you wonder whether over a cup of coffee, discursively, he would defend them, or whether he's trying to move his reader in some way, right? I wonder whether if you sort of like had a cup of tea with Rav Dessler and said, what do you mean no middle ground? Right? Rav Dessler would say, wait, I mean... Obviously, like, I'm not stupid, I'm alive. Like, I know that, like, everybody is middle ground on some level, right? Who have I ever met who's one pole or the other, if we imagine it linearly? But I'm trying to make a point, right? And a point that I make rhetorically to move someone is not necessarily the same point I would make in a graduate seminar in psychology. The only thing that makes me nervous about that is, right, about that approach, is it ends up... If you're too liberal in being willing to do that with thinkers, you sometimes end up taking out the sting of the most radical things they say and mean to be radical. Do you understand what I'm saying? Meaning like, oh, of course he doesn't really mean that. Well, except when he does. So, but I'm tempted to say that because this is a guy who is so psychologically attuned, right? That to say there's no middle ground and to mean something linear by it, which I think is a useful image, hard for me to believe he just sort of would defend that all the way down. But maybe. Rachel, and then Vicky, you want to say something?
I have
and then we'll go this way. I'm sorry, I'm ignoring this side. Yeah.
I just have a clarification question first, and then comment.
Only one? Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it's two things.
Okay. yeah. Go ahead.
My clarification is just you are either a notain or no tap. Like, can you not move between the poles? Like, this moment, I am a notain and. A different moment, I am now a notel, or is it I am a notain throughout my life?
Oh, no, I would assume, based on my reading of him, my understanding of Musar, that he would think, like, if anything, the goal is introspection so that you figure out if your tendency or if your self-definition is notel to work on yourself to be a notain. I mean, there's no point in being a Musarist if you're a total determinist. Right? That one makes no sense, right? I mean, so, no, I don't think it's permanent. In fact, by the way, that's my best argument for why, of course, he doesn't mean it, because if he really means it as absolute, then all the sort of spiritual practices here that we're going to spend time doesn't make any sense, right? The whole point is about the possibility of changing and moving from one to the other, which suggests there A, there's middle ground, and B, there's movement. Now your question,
My comment is that I don't think that he actually means it in this way, but to me it sounds like a very gendered thing, because I don't know of, you know, women who are socialized to believe that an essential aspect of their femaleness is what they can take from the world, whereas I feel like that's sort of very much a component of masculinity and how men are socialized. And so part of me actually is sort of curious whether or not like they're sort of part of his, whether this is directed only, I see this as being directed sort of very much at men, and I'm curious to know whether or not, like, having really none of this, whether it's going to move them.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that sort of historically. I think that Rav Dessler, look, there is a kind of apologetic in traditional Jewish settings that sort of always talks about how women are at a higher spiritual plane, right, and that therefore some of the stuff that men need constantly beaten into them, women already know, right, which is usually coupled with, and this is the reason why women can't do the things that men do, right, it's a complicated apologetic. There's a lot of male power in that valorization of the female, right? Now, I think that what Rav Dessler might say in response, that is, on one level you're right, but be careful about essentializing. Meaning, because there are plenty of women who, right, so they do it emotionally, or they do it some other way, right? Or they live in post-feminism, and they're just as acquisitive, if not more so, than any other men. So, like, it may be a fair point, but it's a point that one has to immediately caveat with some degree of, like, yeah, but let's not get carried away. It reminds me, in a way, your critique is related to the critique I mentioned, I don't remember in what context, of the feminist critique of Tillich and Niebuhr that basically says, right, you say sin is too much self. Actually, women have too little self, not too much self. Right? So I think Tillich and Niebuhr would have both said, on one level, that's fair. On another level, let's not be overly flattering to women. Some women have too much self. Right? So, right? I don't think you disagree with that, I'm guessing, right? But, so, I don't know. I assume most of the people who were involved, as far as I know, in sort of like Musar Chabro were men. But whether he also was talking in a way that women would have heard him, I don't know. The interesting historical question. Vicky.
I would just ask a question. How can one be a notain without being a notel as well? Give, if you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Vicky, the more sort of abstract way of saying what you're saying is that and I think he does have an answer to this, but if all you are is a pure notain, there's something deeply non-relational about that. Or there's something non-reciprocal about that, which you could argue is non-relational. I think that he would say, he does sort of play with this later on, I don't think we'll get time to read this, but you have it in the packet. He does sort of say, it's not that the notail doesn't receive, it's that he doesn't receive with a sense of entitlement and acquisitiveness. Right? It's not about, don't give me love, I don't want it. Right? Don't give me any, no, he's not saying that. He's saying something about it. It goes back to different ways that I think Jordan, Shoshi, Rachi, right, you all said versions of, right, which is, it's about an orientation. He's not talking about being shut off, being like, you know, just I'm just a fountain of generosity and there's nothing else. But rather, that it's a kind of mode of interaction. Where I'm not hungry all the time for people's adoration. I'm not hungry for, right. So, he does have a response to you. Even if the critique is fair, it's not as fair as we at first think. Okay, so like two more comments. Alan, you want to say something, and then anyone who hasn't spoken, and if not, then Tar, and then we'll go forward.
I just want to say, in terms of Musa Finger, it seems really useful, actually, the dichotomy to me. If somebody wants to reflect upon their actions, you know, as the day goes on, like, why am I doing this? Why am I going to be here? What do I want? To think to themselves, am I really here because I think I'm going to get something, or am I here for some other higher purpose? And there, it's just a way of flagging greedy attitudes to reckon with. So I think the idea that there's nothing in between actually has a lot of merit. It also made me think of that, like, four-point kind of Punnett Square thing in Pirkei Avot, where they're like, there's, you know, the people who say, like, what's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine, etc. Like, I don't think it fits on a spectrum, because the same person could be very acquisitive and very aggressive at the same time. Maybe not at the same exact time, but, like, as...
By the way, that sentence, it's interesting. Everything you've said until now, like, I think he would like. I have a feeling that he would argue that at some core level, you can't really be acquisitive and generous at the same time. Whether or not he's right is worth talking about and, like, thinking about. And I think, you know, we're not going to sort of solve that question out, but I actually think you've just gotten to really what he's talking about. Your orientation, right? You can't be, like... You can't be oriented by the question of what can I get or how can this serve me and how can I serve at the same time. I think that's the core of what he's saying. And if you go back to the ratio of what you said, right, the first part of what you said, like there is some really deep truth there, even if you're also suggesting that it might be overstated. Like, right, there's some tension between the first part of what you said and the second part of what you were beginning to say.
Yeah, I guess so.
Or he would argue that there is.
I guess the first part of what I was saying was more... concentrating on what's going on inside people, and the second part was more just how people live in the world, and that it's
right.
possible. I can see, you know, in a situation where there's no, I don't know, where private ownership isn't important in a group of people, and people are constantly taking from other people and giving
right.
to other people. And
right. Okay. All right. So. Here's what I'd like to do for a minute. I would like to spend a few minutes reading the two paragraphs, or reading a few paragraphs together. Then I want to spend maybe 20 minutes in Chavruto reading a little more, and then we'll come back together and discuss it. So first, we're going to look at the first paragraph of Kuntres HaChesed. There's a couple of important things that go on here that I think are important for us and for some of the things we've already been talking about. So I'll read in Hebrew. You could follow in Hebrew and or in English. Kasher bara Elohim et ha'adam, asahu lenotein v'notel. When God created the human being, he made him, God made him a giver and a taker. Koach ha'netina, hu koach elyon mimidot yotzer ha'kol baruchu. The power of giving is, I'm going to translate freely here, is the highest... of God's own attributes. By the way, the English translation that you have is from Rav Dessler's student, Aryeh Carmel. So he says this is like the highest aspect of God. By the way, the Rambam who we read last time would love that, right? Because what do we know about God? The generosity of having created the world. Shehu, God, merachenu meitiv v'notein. God is merciful and beneficent and a giver. Mibli kabel davar bitmura. God gives regardless of whether God gets in return. And then Rav Dessler explains, right? Hey lo yachsar lo klum. After all, God doesn't need anything. God is perfectly self-contained, as it were. Okay? Rak she'anu mevi'im lanu et todatenu, asher zeh shorish avodatenu lo. Now, this might seem like a throwaway line, but it's very, very important, and it makes... a point I've been trying to make, and he makes it actually quite clearly, right? He says, right, God doesn't create or give in order to get something. We express our gratitude because that's what we need to do relationally, but God is not doing it in order to get something back. And then he says, Asher zeh shoresh avodatenu lo. This is the basis of service of God. In other words, this is yet another thinker, like Rabbeinu Bachya, like in a way Heschel, who basically says the basis of the spiritual life or the religious life is gratitude. We start with gratitude. And then, I think this is really kind of important,
the kach asai ta adam, kakatuv betzelem Elohim asai ta adam, ki yuchal lerachem uleiti velitein. He just said something here that's very, very important and like an intervention in the history of Jewish thought, which we talked about in the winter week of learning a little bit, which is, he says, God created the human being in God's image, and what is, seemingly, if I'm reading this passage correctly, what is God's image according to Rav Dessler? Right? You, Rambam, came along and said, it's reason, right? And we talked at length during the College of Learning about A, right? That many of us might want to argue that that's a kind of impoverished conception of the human. Comes Rav Dessler and says, no, the image of God in the human being is the capacity to give generously. Now, we also talk about how Chazal, right, I think, are not interested in this project of saying that's Tzelem Elohim. Tzelem Elohim is the totality of the human being, right, including, as we saw at length, his or her body. But you have this history in Jewish thought of trying to identify that quality of the human being that is Tzelem Elohim. And as I mentioned, you learn a lot about a person's anthropology from how they identify Tzelem Elohim, right? In other words, if I say Tzelem Elohim is reason, clearly I'm obsessed with rationality. If I say Tzelem Elohim is love, that, right, what I say is the image of God is what I most profoundly value. So here Rav Dessler, I mean, I don't know how conscious this is. I think it's actually probably fairly conscious. This is like a critique of the Rambam and his followers who say, oh yeah, Tzelem Elohim, that's reason. Although, if you've studied Rambam with me, you know the Rambam's notion of reason actually ends up in A Life of Generosity also. But to say that it's reason, right, Rav Dessler wants no part of that. And what's interesting here is an assumption that is prevalent in the history of Jewish thought, although I'm not totally sure that Chazal made this link, right? Which is that Tzelem Elohim on the one hand, which we're going to talk about next week, and V'halachta Bidrachav, walking in God's ways on the other, are totally interwoven, right? That the mandate to imitate God is rooted in the fact that we have a shared image. Otherwise, many thinkers say explicitly, and more, I think, assume this implicitly, if we didn't share some image with God, the whole language of walking in God's ways and emulating God's attributes would make no sense, would have no place in Jewish thought. So Tzelem makes the halachta possible, right? So he's saying that here very clearly, right? We are created in the image of God, the God whose highest attribute in some sense is giving and generosity. What it means to be created in the image of God is to have the capacity for generosity. Therefore, generosity is walking in God's ways. That is the height of the spiritual life. All I'm really saying here is something that it may have never occurred to you that these two things were not intrinsically linked, but I'm not sure they always were in Jewish thought. That is, again, that Tzelem and V'halachta are sort of, one is a consequence of the other in a certain way. Or one is a, if you want to put it the other way, one is a the sort of conceptual and existential premise for the other. Right? Without Tzelem Elohim, there would be no possibility of Mahu Afata. Right? Just as God does this, so should you. So there's actually a lot going on in this paragraph. And then he goes on, Aval koach hanetila, hu asher yitaveh adam limshoch elav et kol haba bitchumo. This is why I was translating netila as acquisitiveness. He says the taking is the desire of the human to pull to him or herself everything that's within his range. What's happening here? Everyone's leaving here. Got it. Okay. Koach hanetila, right, is acquisitiveness. Koach zeh hu asher yikru b'nei ha'adam ahavat atzmo. This acquisitiveness is what people mean when they say literally self-love. Now, of course, we would probably in our culture want to talk about a positive version of self-love and a negative version of self-love. I'm almost tempted in this passage to translate this as narcissism. Actually, narcissism and acquisitiveness. And then he says, "V'hu shoresh kol haraot." Acquisitiveness is the basis of basically all the evils in the world. You may remember that in the lecture I gave on Heschel, I talked about how Heschel seems to develop what he calls these two modes of being in the world, the way of expediency and the way of wonder, right? The way of expediency means the fundamental question that orients my life is, how can I use this? And the way of wonder is being asked a question, right? How can I serve? How can I repay? I think that's actually very close in a way to what Rav Dessler is talking about. Although Heschel would never have said the sentence, there's no middle ground. Well, unless Rav Dessler again means something more like would something.
What direction are you going?
Yeah, okay, but, right, all right. That idea, by the way, I don't know exactly what the origins of that idea are, but it's sort of all over the 20th century, and not just in religious texts. I mean, in a different way, there's an element of that in Heidegger's critique of technology as sort of all centered on, you know, how can I use, how can I use, how can I use, even though the other side for Heidegger is not kindness or generosity. It's some weird sort of mystical appreciation of being. And every time I quote serious moral thinkers and mention Heidegger in the same sentence, I feel the need to go to the mikveh afterwards. But nevertheless, you have that a little bit in Heidegger. Interestingly, you think you have this a version of this in Eric Fromm in a secularized way, right? To have and to be. Certain ways is not unrelated to this, right? Trying to have things as opposed to trying to, like, be a particular way in the world. I haven't read Eric Fromm in about 1,000 years. I think I'm vaguely remembering that right. No? Yeah, okay. I don't know either. Eric Fromm, formerly Shiva Bacher. Okay. So this idea, you know, is sort of all over the place. Okay, now, I didn't mark it off, but look for a second. I wanted to show you the line we are talking about it. Look at the second page. And the translation of this is, I'll be giving it out in a few minutes, but I'll just bear with me for a second. The second page, by which I mean the second side of the front page. The first full paragraph, the fourth line, first full sentence, Shnei HaKochot HaEileh, right? These two powers, or maybe better, these two potentials, Shnei HaKochot HaEileh, HaNetina VaHaNetila, you with me? The giving and the taking. This is an interesting claim, right? All other attributes and actions derive from this fundamental. This is the fundamental dichotomy in human experience, life, relation, right? But then he says, "V'yesh lecha ladat," and you should know, "She'ein derech mimutza b'zeh." There is no middle ground. Ki nefesh ha'adam le'olam tish'af le'echad mishnei atzadim. The soul of man, of the human being, always aspires to one pole or the other. Uvitshukat halev hapnimit ein psharot. I find it to be a very strange sentence. In the yearnings of the innermost heart, there are no compromises. That is the, you know, we could spend a year sort of thinking about that sentence. Because I think some people might say in the yearnings of the heart there are only compromises. I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting statement. Or not. Ze haklal, this is the principle, ein memutza behit anyanut, which I will render here as, there is no middle ground where self-interest is concerned. Now, here is a good example of why it seems clear he's not talking about a person, but an orientation, and maybe even an orientation that is fluid, despite the statement that in Memutza, he then says, Nimtza shebechol ma'aseh, bechol dibur uvechol machshava, right? In every action, moment of speech or thought, skip what's between the brackets, I don't want to do that now, what's between the end dashes, Hinahu imit chased venotein, o chotef venotel. By the way, mitchased here does not mean the modern Hebrew mitchased, as in someone who's hypocritically posturing as a giver, but actually one who is transforming oneself as a giver, the real hitzpael in a sense, right? One is either becoming a baal chesed and a giver, or a grabber, chotef, and notel, a taker. And then he suggests that this idea is already in the Netivot, in the Chovot HaLevavot. Okay, so I want to see that inside. Now, I want to look at one other thing together. Wow, we don't have a lot of time. Okay. Look at, this is really just an example of a Musar Drasha. Turn the page to the bottom of page 34. And in the English packets, it's what's also noted as source 2. You can follow in either one. And I just think this is like an interesting example of... there's a tradition that appears in a variety of philosophical sources, which is kind of like, in some ways very understandable, and in other ways very disturbing, right? The tradition that sort of says, well, and in a way it fits with a sort of Neoplatonic conception of the spiritual life, right? Really, your mind and your heart should be focused upstairs, right? Sort of cosmically upstairs. And sort of down here, you sort of go through the motions, but you're really focused somewhere else. Right? Exactly the kind of thing, in a way, that, as talked about, I think, during the college week, Heschel, Buber, Soloveitchik, all in different ways, all want to critique that, you know, by saying, no, the idea is actually sort of bring God here, as opposed to sort of actually not be here in some way. I mean, the Rambam, for example, at one moment in the guide, talks about how, you know, one part of you is like dealing with your business, but the rest of you is, you know, contemplating God. And it seems to me that the Musar tradition is also, in its way, extremely committed to undermining that temptation, because, after all, if you're supposed to be giving to other humans, being present might be a constitutive piece of that. So he says, he's now going to do a great midrash, on a midrash. Actually, he's going to quote, attributed to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of Musar. He says, okay, Batorah katuv, in the Torah it says, Vayitalei Chanoch et ha-Elohim. And Chanoch walked with God. Ve'amru Chazal, and our sages said, in this... Chanoch tofer min alima yaya. Chanoch was a shoemaker. Ve'al kol tzira v'tzira haya miyached yichudim lekono. And with every stitch that he made, he would do these Kabbalistic unifications of God. Meaning, on some level, what seems to be the pshat is, yeah, I'm stitching my shoes, but I'm not really here. I did not get a chance to look up. I don't know. Midrash Talpiot, we're talking late, right? Chazal don't talk about being miyached yichudim. Okay? And now, this is now Rav Dessler talking. V'shamati b'shem Rabbeinu Yisrael misalant zatzal, right? Shebi'er ha-ma'amar hazeh be'ur nechmad. Nechmad, by the way, not in the sort of like paltry Hebrew way of nice, but nechmad is in like amazing, like really just delightful. It's probably a good translation. Vayomer, and he said, "Ki ena kavana shebishat tfirato hayadavek b'machshavot elyonot." Right. Of course, the meaning of this midrash is not that Chanoch, while he was sewing shoes, was thinking thoughts about heaven. Shezeh asur min hadin, because that's usur. By law. Ki ech yifaneh da'ato l'davar acher, or ech yifaneh da'ato l'davar acher, b'sha'af she'osek v'melechet acherim asher s'charuhu. Someone hires you for your time, you have an obligation to be focused on what they're paying you for. Not, oh yeah, like I'm using my hands for this, but I'm somewhere else. That, he says, is against halakha. Can't be the midrash means this. This is, you know, a great example of a sort of, in its own way, very understated. I mean, it's not understated, but it's understated in who it's criticizing. Right? I'm just saying pshat and chazal. Right? I am not critiquing the Rambam, or, God forbid, the author of this midrash. Right? Or lots of other sources that talk about, you know, dividing your consciousness. Ella, and this is this amazing move he makes, Ella, tochen hayichudim shayam yached. What are the unifications that he was involved in? Hu asher sam alibo umachshavto bichol tfira v'tfira ki tiye tova v'chazaka v'chi yu hamin alim tovim leman yehaneh mehem asher yena'alem. What is the yichudim? I actually want to make sure we're clear about this for a second. It means that he was absolutely and totally present in the act of sewing and thinking about the benefit he hoped that the person who was going to buy the shoes from him would derive from them. Now, how is that miyached yichudim? We're going to get there in a second. But he says, that's of course what any pious person who's being paid will be focused on doing the task he or she has committed to doing. Now, this is really, really interesting. Kacha davak chanoch b'midat kono. Asher yeti v'yehaneh lezulato. V'kacha yiched lo yichudim. What does liyached yichudim mean, says Rabbi Yisrael Salant? The absolute unification of my will with God's attribute of giving. It's amazing, right? We're not in some obscure Lurianic formula where I am, you know, saying various sentences and they are kind of, you know, affecting some kind of theurgic repair in the cosmos. No. Yichud means I am completely tying myself to God's aspect of generosity. Giving. That's what I do. That's what it means that Chanoch Hayam Yached Yichudim. Again, I'm not asking you whether this is pshat in the Midrash Talpiot. I just lost my place. Okay. Ki lo chafetz chanoch b'shum davar acher zulat hachefetz ha'echad v'hashifa miyuchedet l'davek b'midot kono. The only thing that Chanoch ever wanted, this is what it means that he was miyached yichudim, was like God, was to walk in God's ways and to cleave to God's attributes, that is, to be a giver. Okay, I guess we'll read the next sentence too. Actually, when you read the translation that I gave you here from Aryeh Carmel, he has this very weird thing that he does, and I didn't edit his translation, where he translates Dvekut as if Rav Dessler were some kind of Hasidic master, and he actually a couple of times will say he will render Dvekut as ecstatic attachment to God, right? Which strikes me as, the whole point here is that's exactly wrong, right? He's actually talking about sober presence, which is an attachment to God's qualities, right? There's nothing ecstatic about being a shoemaker who's totally focused on the quality of the shoe because that's what I've been paid to do and I want someone to derive benefit for it. Ecstatic is exactly the word I would never use in this context. Okay, so then he says, "Va'od acheret lo b'zeh, ki nishmar mikol shemetra." Another consequence of being totally focused on only doing the thing he's been assigned to do, "Shegam shkaga shkagat ona avetarmit lo tigienu, velo tiyeh benetilato yete." Sorry, lo tiyeh benetilato yetera al erech avodato asher yitain. By being totally focused, he's aware of exactly how much he's supposed to be paid and no more. Right? He makes sure that there's no ripping off. I just actually, you know, whatever it's worth, I just find this to be an amazing example of sort of late midrash, right? A midrash on a midrash. And it really captures the heart of what Musar is talking about, and it's a much more I have a feeling that Chazal would have liked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's reinterpretation of this midrash more than the midrash itself. Right? That it's actually about being present in the thing you're doing. And it's not unrelated to something we talked about a very long time ago, maybe the beginning of this year, I think, that Rav Kook text about Bechol Drachecha Da'ehu, right? About knowing God and everything you do, where Rav Kook actually says, right, when you're doing kindness for someone, it is forbidden to be thinking about prayer or learning. Right? It's forbidden to do that. The only thing you can be thinking about is how to do lasting good for the person in front of you. By the way, and vice versa. But, you know, this is related to that. It's actually about no. Because Bechol Drachecha Da'ehu is a critique of the notion that says, oh, there's something that's totally secular that I can only be sort of half committed to. right? It actually is an argument that, right, if you take the notion of every action being potentially sacred, there's no reason to sort of split your consciousness. That's the argument anyway, right? That's the basic orientation. Okay, any comments or questions about what we've just done? And then I want to shift gears a little bit. Anybody? Okay. So I'm now going to give you some questions, although you've already seen some of this. Now, what I'm going to ask people to do is look at what I marked as sources 3, 4, and 5. It's now 11:33. We'll come back together in about 20, 25 minutes. Let's see how people do with this. And what we're really going to focus on for the next little bit in Chavrutot is the following question. What is the relation between giving and loving? Because Rav Dessler, I think, is going to come along and try to work in a way that for many of us is going to seem counterintuitive, although it will be related to things we've already been talking about both last time and this. Okay, so we're reading sources 3, 4, and 5. In the Hebrew, they're marked, and in the English, that's all you have. If you end up going further, you should just know that number 6 in the English and number 6 in the Hebrew do not correspond. It's sort of my mistake. So whatever, and then 7 and 8 go back to corresponding. But I'm really most interested in doing 3, 4, and 5. Okay? Any questions about what we're doing? Sorry, everyone has. Did everyone get a question sheet to help me? No? Oh, yeah, question.
The numbers on here match the numbers of the sources?
Yes, the numbers on here. There's, you may even notice that some of these numbers have several questions, right? It's actually based on paragraphs. You can't ask a dumb question when I'm standing here trying to figure out how you turn off a tape recorder. I mean, what could be dumber than me right up here?